Good luck.
Okay, we'll call to order the House Revenue Committee meeting. Welcome members and guests today. What, you all are here to testify on the hotel motel bill. That was yesterday. Either that or there's a high interest in a couple of our work sessions today. Or perhaps it could be the presentation. We're going to take some work sessions first, and then we'll be inviting Senate members to come down to sit in our informational meeting. Let's open with a work session on House Bill 3118. I'll open that work session. As I recall, this we were discussing moving this bill to Ways and Means Committee. Is that right?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I'm going to bring us up to date, Representative Butlers.
Mr. Chair, what this does is require the individuals to the Department of Revenue to put a place on the tax forms for individuals to list the school district in which they're reside in. So for individual income taxpayers, they would put the school district, and also this would be true for corporate income taxpayers. So there would just be additional information that would be on the tax form. And it does have a subsequent to Ways and Means to look at the fiscal implications for the Department of Revenue.
Okay. Any questions about 3118?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative
Berger. I move that House Bill 3118 make the subsequent move to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Yeah, I believe that's a motion to the floor, with the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, is there any discussion on the motion? There are no amendments, right?
No amendments.
Okay. All right. If there's no discussion, please call the roll.
Barnhart?
Aye.
Carter?
Aye.
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 Aye. Berger?
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 3118 goes to the Ways and Means Committee. It goes to the floor via Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. We'll close the work session on that. Then let's go to a work session on House Bill 3134. And we have some amendments.
Mr. Chair, you have the dash three amendments on the House Bill 3134. And most all of the dash three amendments are the dash twos. The exception being the last page four, lines 18 through 22, or the new edition, based on your discussion in the work session earlier this week. And what these amendments are intended to do is to direct the Department of Revenue to account for a tax lien certificate program at the county level. Remember, this is permissive language, so the counties would elect this option. And if they did that, then the Department of Revenue, when determining percentages for distribution of statewide grants from the CAFA fund, would take that into account. There isn't any specific percentage change, but they would take into account the data that the county provides in terms of the revenue they brought in terms of how it's affected their budget when they determine that percentage.
Okay. John Phillips, are you out there somewhere? There you are. Thank you. You're usually easier to find. Do you want to talk to us for a minute about these dash threes?
Yes, Mr. Chair. John Phillips with the Department of Revenue. Dash threes, as Paul mentioned, do what the dash twos were doing and add that one section that says that to the extent that the sale of tax lien certificates by any particular county affects other counties, then we have the ability to adjust the formula.
Okay.
And leaves it pretty broad, but we think we can work within this.
Okay. Commissioner Milne, why don't you stay there, John, in case there are any questions. Do you want to say anything about the dash threes?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The dash threes do what we were anticipating, what our intent was to add to the bill to clarify that so that there's no harm to the county.
Okay. Diane Bell. Come on.
today.
For those of you who haven't been here before, we've heard this bill on a couple of occasions, so we sort of are speaking in code here. If it seems like this isn't making any sense to you, it's because you weren't here for the first two chapters.
Earlier episode.
Diane?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, committee members, Diane Belt, Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors. Really haven't had a chance to look at them, but I think basically all it's saying is that the department will have the opportunity to look at the CAFA fund and how it's distributed and then make a determination on how those funds are if a county participates, right? Okay. The only other question that we kind of had, I think, was on the Dash 2 amendment. I have a little concern over what that's doing on line 14. That says the sale of tax lien certificate is not subject to any limitation under ORS 311-785. That particular statute refers to the county cannot compromise or the tax or the interest. And when I read this, it says then that that does give the county the authority to do that on a tax lien sale, and I'm not sure that that was the intent. Or that should be the intent.
All right. Any questions for any of these witnesses? Oh, okay. Christina? Yeah, come on up. If you could make room for Christina Squire.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Just briefly for the record, Hasina Squire is here today on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. I don't know where my cohort is from the League of Oregon Cities, but last time you heard this bill.
We're going to wait and see.
Yeah. Having not seen the Dash 3 amendments, it doesn't seem like very much has changed in this bill. For those of you who are new on this committee, I know Representative Shetterly is very attuned to the fact that during the 1998 interim, there was a very large work group that dealt with assessment and taxation funding. We had many, many meetings during the 1998 summer. It pretty much ruined the summer for all of us, and then House Bill 2139 came up during the 1999 session. We just want to express our concern for the potential that this creates and in maybe a loss in A&T funding, and recognize that that is an extremely important program to all taxing districts. If it does create a loss in A&T funding, we will be very opposed to the legislation and to the administrative rulemaking process that implements it. Our taxing districts rely on these folks to collect our property taxes. We've had lots of battles in the past over whether or not we should pay into the county's A&T funding program, and so we're concerned about upsetting the balance of that issue. And yes, this is permissive. It is permissive for county commissioners to make this decision. I don't see an outpouring of county commissioners here today asking for that. I don't see Association of Oregon Counties, who represents all of the counties, supporting this legislation. I haven't heard that yet. And while it is permissive for each county to choose to make this decision, they are making that policy decision for all of the taxing districts that lie within their jurisdiction. So we are concerned about this bill.
Okay. Well, Hasina, just to follow up on yours, I don't see an outpouring of votes for the Dash 3 amendments or the bill at this point anyway either. So I think I'm going to close the work session on this and not take action on House Bill 3134 today. Close the work session on that. Let's go to a work session on HJR 18. You coming back?
Well, it depends on whether or not I get my arm broke.
What committee is Dr. Bates in? HJR 18. Oh, is he really? Well, if that's the case, we may want to wait off on this until he's back.
In which case, we could go to the presentation and come back to this end.
Okay. Well, did I open the work session? Well, let me just recess the work session. Steve Myers is still in legislative fiscal, in which case then, committee, I think we'll take a break and go to the presentation. But let's stand at ease for about 2 minutes while we invite our Senate colleagues to come down and join us. And then we will come back. Representative Kefouri was stuck in traffic and asked us to delay until later in the meeting on House Bill 3184. Representative Scott said he couldn't understand or empathize with that. And if we're still working in legislative fiscal on HJR 18, we'll defer action on that too and just go ahead and take up the presentation. Let's stay at ease for about 30 seconds, which is in our time about 2.5 minutes.
Thank you.
Did that surprise you?
No, not particularly. Yeah. I told Patty we'd take a look at the amendments to see if that changed anything.
Hey, Patty. How you doing?
Amazing how we can smoke.
Yeah, I mean, it has merit. But I think that's some thing.
I don't know what I mean.
That's right. What are those black things circling, Daddy?
It's all the state's fault. It's branded on the left.
And you hate to, you know, you hate to make a decision based on that.
Go ahead, everybody else does.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, it sort of gives you a flavor of, you know, who plays in this kind of shadowy other world.
And that's exactly what.
Tell them. It's all our fault.
That's exactly what.
What?
She does have a very different perspective.
Yeah. Anyway, they've been trying to figure out a way to buy the thing.
Zero.
It's a tough business. You know, I don't
really.
Did you see this?
Well, and personality.
Oh, gee.
No, I mean personnel. I mean trying to keep people, because if they're good, they go off, they establish. If they're bad, then you lose.
Yeah.
The whole shop loses. I mean, it's a tough.
I said we were.
I feel for him.
I said we were at ease.
Thank you.
Well, Representative Hess, as we were saying, just call me Representative Williams.
Yes, sir, Representative Williams.
I've heard worse.
Sorry, that came out wrong. What I was referring to is what we were talking about when it was running that we didn't know.
Yeah.
Yep.
So do you need anything more in the paper?
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, I think I'm okay. I don't know. Are you running the session today?
Probably.
Are we going to go through all of
them? I don't know. If we're starting at
Yeah, so I don't think they'll get up.
Yeah,
probably. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, no, I'm right, sure we'll be carrying over by then. The minority report's probably going to take a while. Those things always slow things down.
Yeah, there's at least a dozen bills.
I think there's 18.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why. So maybe I will.
I
got a feeling it's not.
If you need any other information, if
maybe
you
I will come down and.
Brian, look at us.
All right, we will call ourselves back to order after that 30 seconds. Committee, through the course of the session so far, we've received informational overviews, and also for our guests here, informational overviews on various revenue-related policy matters. We've heard from local governments, we've heard from business, we've heard from labor, education, and one group that we've had on the calendar on several occasions, and because of the crush of businesses we've gotten along, always had to move along, was the Revenue Coalition. So you are our guests today for your overview. We know you by your leaflets. We see them. And now we have the faces to put with these leaflets. And we do welcome you to the House Revenue Committee. And we'll turn the meeting over to Lori Wimmer-Whalen and Tim Nesbitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Lori Wimmer-Whalen with the Oregon Education Association, also the chair of the Oregon Revenue Coalition. And we have a presentation for you today. The Oregon Revenue Coalition is an ad hoc group of organizations that came together originally to advocate for increasing available revenues for the next biennial budget. Most of our member organizations are interested in long-term revenue solutions as well to what they perceive to be a broken tax system. But as our group grew, it became increasingly obvious to us that the focus of our coalition would be best developed in the direction of the Oregon's 350 tax expenditures. Our group includes school advocates, human service groups, private and public unions, children's rights organizations, civil rights groups, members of the faith community, long-term care advocates, and various other nonprofit organizations, as well as local governments. And at this time, I'd like all of the people in the room who are affiliated with us in some way and support this to please stand so that you can see who we are. Thank you. The Oregon Revenue Coalition seeks to enhance revenues available for appropriations by focusing on several related areas. First of all, we have been advocating for suspending or canceling enough tax expenditures to close the revenue gap for 2003-05. We also advocate for stopping passage of new tax giveaways or extensions that will only exacerbate the shortfall. And finally, we've advocated from ending the automatic reconnect to the federal tax code and thank this committee for its work on that. While many member groups also will advocate for new taxes, as I've said, or tax rate increases, the coalition itself has fine-tuned its focus on the tax expenditure solution as the most viable for the short term. We began by examining the 350 tax breaks in current law and quickly came to the conclusion that a methodological look that was based on the values of this legislature and of the state of Oregon, as determined by a consensus list of criteria, would be helpful as we attempted to evaluate these tax expenditures. One idea led to another, and before we knew it, we were working on draft 13 of the document that you have handed out before you today with the green cover. It's our hope that the ideas we offer will provoke a movement toward a legislative process that parallels that of the Ways and Means Committees in scrutiny of expenditures on the direct program side. Just as we have a spending limit, for example, on programs, perhaps we ought to have a spending limit on tax breaks. And just as every existing and new program proposal is put through its paces and squared up with the overall goals of the state in the Ways and Means process, we believe that tax expenditures and new proposals for them also ought to be examined with similar methodological rigor. This year, the state published its fourth tax expenditure report. The legislation that created this report also contemplated that a process such as the one we're recommending be conducted periodically by this body. In part, the statute reminds us that tax expenditures ought to be reviewed for fairness and accuracy. It asks the legislature to fund only those tax expenditures that can be shown to be effective in meeting the purpose for which they were passed, and, in terms of economics, efficiently so. That same statute declares that it is in the state's interest to undertake such an analysis beyond simply publishing the list,
and even to revisit the policies underlying those tax expenditures that cannot be shown to be, quote, most fiscally effective means of achieving each purpose, compared with a more direct program approach.
And for the record, I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. I'll pick up now, and let me start by telling you a story from my high school years. I had a biology teacher whose method of teaching was to tell us to take the fish, go to the lab, cut it up, and report back to him on what we found. And we would do that and come back and report on the number of fins and so on, the biology of the fish, and we'd give our report to the teacher, and he'd say, study the fish. And we'd go back to the lab, and we'd cut it up some more and report back on what we found, and he'd say, study the fish. And after six or four iterations of that, he eventually satisfied himself that through our own observation and thinking, we had learned about the biology of the fish. Well, we've applied a similar approach here. We dissected all 350 tax expenditures. We looked at them one by one, and we tried to do so with a sharp eye and an open mind. And what we did is look at them in the aggregate by thesaurus, those which affect the cities and counties and school districts at the local level, those at the state level, by source, property taxes, income taxes, and one by one and item by item. Again, all 350 tax breaks. We assigned purposes to each tax break, which actually was not that difficult to do. And if you look at page 3 of the report, you'll see that we list, again, without saying whether we believe these are valid public purposes, we listed the apparent purpose for each tax break, some quite easy to identify, like making housing more affordable or promoting charitable giving, assisting the disabled, and on and on. And you see them there listed by their purpose. In addition, we also assigned a beneficiary. Certain tax breaks benefit individual taxpayers, others benefit business taxpayers, some a combination of the two. Some are basically focused on employers and employees and their relationship, those which affect, for instance, not taxing health benefits provided by employers, which benefit both employers and employees. And on page 4, you see the listing we came up with for beneficiaries. And again, we took these at face value. We did not attempt to apply any value judgments at this point of our inquiry. And the result of this exercise can be found in Exhibit A, where we have listed all 350 tax breaks according to their apparent purpose and their apparent beneficiaries. And with these purposes and beneficiaries assigned, we then proceeded with our analysis. And first we looked at the big picture, at the aggregate of all state and local tax breaks combined, and found that state and local tax expenditures grew by 27% from 97-99 to 01-03. While revenues grew only by 15% in the same period. So tax expenditures have been growing faster than tax collections. And we now give away more money in tax breaks, totally, than we collect in taxes. 42 cents collected for every dollar of taxes, every nominal dollar of taxes which we levy, and 58 cents is given away in the form of tax credits, deductions, exclusions, and exemptions. We also found that if tax breaks have been held to a constant percentage of revenues since 97-99, that the state and our cities and counties and school districts would have had an additional $1.4 billion in the current biennium. And then looking just at state-level tax breaks, and keeping in mind that the newly released co-chair's budget puts us back close to the 99-01 spending level, we note that if we were to restore the 99-01 level of tax breaks at the state level, you would have an additional $857 million to work with in 03-05. So the fact that these tax breaks have been growing faster than revenue collections has had a big impact on, obviously, on your resources. We also came up in our inquiry with a term of our own devising called the revenue recovery rate, which we define as the amount of revenue collected versus the revenue that would be received if the tax were applied across the board with no exceptions. That 58 cents, 42 cents analogy. But we looked at it in more detail, as the next slide will show you. We looked at each tax type from income through other state taxes, property tax, gas and fuel, the number of tax breaks, and the revenue recovery rate. And you'll see that on the income tax, we recover in revenue 55 cents for every dollar that we levy in taxes, the other 45 cents given away, again, in credits, exemptions, exclusions. Now, the property tax rate would appear to have a very low revenue recovery rate, the property tax, but we looked further, and for instance, when we adjust for the fact that not all property can be taxed, we don't tax federal lands, and we've chosen over the years, over the decades actually, not to consider intangible assets like stocks and bonds to be subject to property tax. So when you adjust for those two factors, the property taxes, the revenue recovery rate for the property tax rises to 72 cents on the dollar. However, there's very little of those kinds of adjustments to make on the income tax side. And therefore, the income tax, upon further analysis, stands out at the low level of a 55-cent revenue recovery rate. And we looked further at the corporate income tax and found that it has only a 45-cent revenue recovery rate. So those two taxes, for this reason and others, which I'll mention in a moment, became the primary focus of our further inquiries here.
Our look at the purposes for which tax expenditures have been enacted led us to list in order of magnitude, that is, categorized from most to least expensive, those public purposes. Our own revenue coalition criteria matched that of the state in most cases. We believe, for instance, that in addition to direct appropriation to services in these worthy categories, some tax inducements can be seen as effective tools for encouraging certain outcomes, such as enhancing access for targeted groups to such basics as housing, health care, and education. We also believe that in some instances, targeted and localized tax expenditures may produce good jobs within reasonable cost parameters. These, then, are our criteria for evaluating the tax expenditures that we'd argue ought to be retained at least at some level. Here's the rest of the list. You'll notice that in addition to promoting well-being among citizens, there exists a category that we set aside of tax expenditures that we consider technically useful or necessary, and the final three in italics on this list on the slide fit that description. We found in our research, however, that not all 350 tax expenditures are justifiable on the grounds of this very generous list of public purposes. Some tax breaks do not serve any discernible public purpose in our estimation. Still others make dubious claims that bear further scrutiny. You will find in your report on the fourth spreadsheet at the back a list of 45 business tax giveaways, for instance, whose purpose is yet to be determined. Another 126 business tax breaks on that list have what we believe are tenuous connections at best to the prospect of good job creation. In fact, we found only five tax expenditures that appear to directly create good jobs. These are the Strategic Investment Program and Enterprise Zone expenditures. To that point, how does the Oregon Revenue Coalition view economic development tax breaks? We asked whether the expenditures could produce and sustain jobs at a cost-effective level. We scrutinized the expenditures for built-in accountability features so that the recipients of the tax break would actually have to deliver on the promise of providing new jobs. Incidentally, with these criteria in mind, the coalition has asked the revenue committees to enact or extend new job development tax expenditures only if they are paired with the retirement of an existing tax break that fails to meet these tests and that takes a similar bite out of future revenues so that they end up revenue neutral.
And as you'll see on pages 5 and 6 of our report, and further on, in the report as well, we devoted a lot of thought to the issue of the business tax breaks, beginning with the recognition that proponents of business tax breaks invariably rest their case on jobs, on creating and sustaining jobs. So we put five of the business tax breaks in a purpose category called create jobs because, as Laurie mentioned, they passed our tests for tax breaks that are quite specific to that purpose, and they involve the Strategic Investment Program and the Enterprise Zones. But we found another 153 tax breaks for business totaling $9.2 billion in revenues foregone that are not as specific to jobs or not available to all segments of the
business community. And the detail on that are on pages 5 and 6 of the report. And then we computed a cost per job for all the business tax breaks and found an average of $2,714 in revenue foregone for each job in our economy. Now, that's just one possible yardstick for you to use in assessing the cost efficiency of new proposals to create or sustain jobs. There may be others. Perhaps your OTIM model could provide another measure. But that's one which we did based on total tax breaks identified for business and the total number of jobs, including self-employment, in our economy. And you'll see also on pages 5 and 6 of the report, we ended up categorizing and looking at business tax breaks in a few different categories. One, those that benefit all of our businesses, regardless of the type of industry or type of product they produce. For instance, those that provide for the accelerated depreciation of equipment are available to all forms of businesses. Or on the property tax side, those that exempt inventories are obviously available to any kind of a corporation that has any kind of inventories. Then there are those that are designed for particular businesses, for example, property tax break for breaks for farm and forest land, and income tax write-offs for insurance companies. Those that are project-specific, again, are related to enterprise zones and SIPs, and there's another category here, too, where we have enterprise zones available to certain industries that you're trying to promote. For instance, telecommunications have some specific provisions for setting up enterprise zones and fostering the startup and operation of those industries. But I think the most important message we have for you today is that this tax expenditure book that we've been talking about and which we dissected really only tells half the story. The other half of the story is contained in this budget, the direct expenditures. And we submit that it's going to be important to make a fair and informed judgment on the value of these tax breaks based on comparing and weighing the revenue foregone from each of these tax breaks to what the revenue could be used for. And that's why we prepared the what $1 million buys list that you've seen in prior testimony. $1 million might seem like a paltry amount when you're dealing with an $11 billion budget, but $1 million buys in-home care for 77 seniors in a year, crisis services for 1,637 persons battling mental illness, seven state troopers on the job for 2 years, or higher education for 90 to 100 students, or a day of school for 51,000 K-12 students. And that's why we began to call attention to not just the rationale for these tax breaks, and we want you to understand that by presenting a list and calling into question what's in this book, we're not doing that to point fingers. We're not doing that with a sense of recrimination. All these things came into effect because you and your colleagues at one time or another thought they served a good purpose, were affordable, cost-effective. Now I think we have a very different climate, and so what we're asking you is to take another look, to re-examine, and to ask yourselves, given the purpose of these, given their beneficiaries, given most importantly the revenue foregone and how that revenue could otherwise be used, what can you do to balance this book, the tax expenditure report, or to revise this book in a way that helps to balance this one, your direct expenditure budget. We've come up with our recommendations for how to approach this. This is where our thinking took us. That you look at the tax expenditures with the criteria that I've described in mind, and then look at those you think should be retained as is, those you think should be repealed because they no longer serve a good purpose or they don't do so cost effectively, and those which you think should be reduced or revised. So it's the retain, repeal, or reduce 3 R's approach that we're recommending for your consideration. Again, vis-a-vis the demands on your direct expenditure budget and the cuts in services that you're being forced to make by declines in revenue collections. Let me give you some examples of each. In the category of tax expenditures we think could be repealed, we urge you to look at the extraterritorial income exclusion. It's a $24.9 million item in the next budget. It's something that you never voted to create. It was created because the feds created it, and when you were connected to the federal tax code, it automatically became part of Oregon's tax code. It subsidizes the operations of only a small number of Oregon corporations, and it's been found to be an illegal trade subsidy by the World Trade Organization. with that, if you were to repeal that particular tax break, the $24.9 million would fund a full school year for 1,000 children, Oregon health plan coverage for 1,290 Oregonians, and in-home care for 345 seniors, and get you a payback of $21.7 million in matching federal funds for those Oregon health plan and senior services investments. Another example, and this fits more in the reduce or revise category. It's a good thing to have a tax break to help working families and others afford to own their own homes. There's no question about that. But why should we extend this kind of housing assistance to owners of second homes and vacation homes? By the way, I'm one of them. When we looked at the effect of mortgage interest deductions on the income tax and property tax deductions on the income tax, not for a primary residence, but for a second home, we found that we will give away $42 million in income tax revenues for these deductions on second homes in the next biennium, enough to pay for 30 days of school for every second grade class in the state, which leads to a question of priorities here. Is it our priority to subsidize second homes at the beach or to educate second graders in our schools? We have other examples. Let me just give you two more, because I don't want you to think we're just picking on things that don't apply for the most part to our members, although I just gave you the example of second homes. The political contribution tax credit. If that were to be reduced by just 20%, rolling it back from $50 to $40, we would raise $1.8 million, which is enough to provide Oregon health plan coverage for 4,644 Oregonians and generate another $2.7 million in federal funds. Okay. For another example, just last session you created the Trust for Cultural Development. That's likely to result in revenues foregone totaling $17.9 million in the next biennium. We know just 2 years ago you thought it was a good thing. We expect you still think it's a good thing. But if you rolled that credit back from $500 to $400, you would raise $3.6 million. You'd still be accomplishing a lot of its purpose. You'd raise $3.6 million, and maybe you could use that $3.6 million to provide the funding that the co-chair's budget deletes for Oregon Public Broadcasting, $3.45 million, which, by the way, we think also serves a lot of the same purposes as the Cultural Trust. Now, back to our kind of overarching recommendations. Something that you've already acted on the House side and we appreciate is ending the automatic connection to the federal tax code. We think it makes every bit of sense to do that and, to regain your own authority over tax policy decisions on the state tax code. We looked at two other kind of overarching ways of looking at the totality of tax breaks. If we reduced all property and income tax breaks by 25%, excluding what we can't tax, like federal lands, and what we choose not to tax, like intangibles, stocks and bonds, that would raise $3.1 billion for the state and for schools and for cities and counties in the next biennium. Or if we look just at the income tax and decided to tax, if you decided to cap income tax expenditures, which of course directly affect your own budget, at 33 cents on the dollar, so that for every $3 in revenues you collect, you decide you're going to give away in tax breaks no more than $1, that would raise $1.7 billion in the next biennium. And still leave plenty of room to provide to maintain tax breaks which serve a good purpose. We ended up looking with a lot more scrutiny, and Exhibit D of the document you have focuses on the income tax because of several factors. One is obviously it directly affects your general fund. Secondly, it's based on ability to pay, whereas the property tax is not. So we feel it's more appropriate to apply a tougher standard of scrutiny and tougher thresholds for approval to income tax breaks than property tax breaks. As you've heard in prior testimony at this committee, when you're imposing a property tax on things like cargo containers, you're putting our state or our ports at a competitive disadvantage with other states. And you can go through a whole long list of property tax breaks for businesses which have a big impact on our competitive standing with other states. But the impact's not nearly so great when you look at the income tax. Most business investment decisions are driven by income tax policies at the federal level with a rate of 35%. Our rate is 6.6% on the corporate. And that's kind of the tail of the dog. We think if we're looking at competitiveness factors from state to state, yes, be very concerned about the property tax, but don't be overly concerned about the income tax. And finally, income taxes, because they're based on ability to pay, are kinder to businesses during a recession. If you're not making a profit, you're not paying. If you're making less of a profit, you're paying less. And so the thrust of our recommendations and our request to you is to pay closer attention, put the most effort into looking at what we now give away in the form of income tax breaks rather than in the form of property tax breaks. And finally, we want to give you a sense of the magnitude of difference between these two books I was holding up. Governor's budget, $11.4 billion general fund, at least the one that came out in January, and you're now working on a number slightly smaller than that. This tax expenditure report, $7.7 billion, just in state-level taxes, almost all the income tax. So what we're asking and what I think the statutes that authorize the creation of the tax expenditure report urge you to do is to look carefully at these tax breaks in the context of your budget. We also would ask that you establish a moratorium on all new tax breaks that are not offset by the repeal of less compelling tax breaks of similar cost. And as one way to proceed, we would recommend appointment of a short-term work group over the next several weeks to look at establishing and working and living within a cap of something like 33 cents on the dollar for income tax breaks, which has the potential of yielding $1.7 billion in recovered revenue to help balance the budget and restore services for Oregonians.
I'd like to thank the chair and the committee for your attention as we've worked through this PowerPoint presentation for you and allowing us to give you a sense of our perspective on the world. We're certainly happy to answer any questions at this time that you might have.
Well, thank you, and I want to welcome our Senate members who have joined us, Senator Corcoran, Senator Perioli, Senator Deckert. I'd be happy to answer. I'm happy to receive any questions. Senator Perioli, you want to lead off?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I'd like to commend the work of this group. I think the questions that they're bringing to the table are excellent questions, and I would support the concept of a working group to review these issues. I do have some concerns, although it appears that from just a cursory reading of the report, Mr. Chairman, you'd think that there was a lot of low-hanging fruit here to be gathered. But I just point out on page 4 and 5 a couple of concepts that are connected to other public policy issues. And I think this illustrates why I think the working group ought to be convened. First of all, on page 5, under in the bottom part of the table, agricultural tax breaks account for $311.3 million. And then at the very end of that column, timber operations account for $613.9 million. So you've got about $1 billion worth of tax breaks there. If you look at these sectors, they're either the second or third largest sector in the state of Oregon for productivity and employment. If you add them together, they are the largest sector in the state of Oregon. The largest tax breaks are also connected to our most expensive public policy, which is, in fact, land use policy in Oregon that protects agricultural land from development and protects forest land from development. So those tax breaks are definitely connected to our largest employment and productivity sectors, and they're also connected to our possibly, arguably, the most important public policy sector, which is our land use planning that protects ag land and forest land. If you look at page 4, you've also got $511 million in taxes listed as standing timber exclusion. And again, that is also connected to the idea that we're trying to protect forest land for forest productivity and incent landowners by providing a tax break on standing timber so that they'll grow their timber through a full rotation. So those three elements alone are $1.5 billion, roughly. The other issue, similarly sort of buried in the personal property tax exclusion, is the idea that we would tax stocks, bonds, trademarks, and patents, which I'm sure would include patents on software development and investments. And, you know, we are arguably, with our enterprise zones and other incentives to bring business to the community, have committed significant resources over the past decade to bring software developers and investors into Oregon so that they will contribute by building plants and hiring folks and putting people to work in the high-tech sector. So this essentially would be the software tax and the investor tax. So I guess I'm suggesting that the three largest sectors, software or science of the mind or high technology, is connected to broad public policy in Oregon, just as agriculture and forestry is connected to broad public policy, even including our land use system. So, you know, there's almost $2 billion worth of the potential savings, which are connected to far broader public policy and have bigger implications. I think those are the kind of things that we would need to consider on every one of these tax implications.
Mr. Chair?
You want to respond? Sure.
Yes, please. First of all, I wanted to acknowledge the Senator for pointing those things out. We are aware of that. That's one of the reasons that we are focusing more on the income tax side than the property tax side. A number of those that you listed have mostly are property tax breaks, and we couldn't agree more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let me prepare the audience. Prepare your eyes. I'm going to ask Kara to bring the lights back up.
Mr. Chair, if I could add, you know, the big number is $27 billion in tax breaks, but a lot of those are property tax breaks. A lot of those are intangible property that we don't tax. That's why we went over to the income tax side, $7.7 billion. That's where we think we should be applying the most scrutiny. And as the Senator mentioned, there are a lot of tax breaks which serve a good purpose through our property tax code. Where we think the competitiveness factor is most in play. And also, you see in the same pages that the Senator was referring to a list of the number of jobs supported in each sector. But we have a number of caveats there, because a lot of the jobs, especially in the manufacturing sector, have high multipliers. They support other jobs. And so we don't want people to be overly focused on the cost per job either. Those we just put out there as potential yardsticks. But we are very sensitive in this economy, obviously, and given the state's budget problem, with the need to create and sustain good jobs. We think that ought to be a purpose in and of itself. And we're willing to work with you to make sure we don't do anything to deter a job creation.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I think we're all talking the same kind of language here. Senator Fairley only talked about the low-hanging fruit. And it does look like, when you look at the gross numbers, it looks like there must be some easy picking in there. And not to say that there isn't, but it's hard to make the easy picking add up to big numbers. I was a survivor of the brave march through the tax expenditure report in 1999. And now you had your chart there. Was it reduce? What was it? Reuse, recycle? No.
Retain, reduce. And repeal.
And the one you left off from 99 was enhance. Because as we went through in 99 and got to looking at some of these, we thought, hey, these serve a good policy. We should make these better. And I remember that I think in 99 we eliminated all of, what, four or five? And I think the net savings was $300,000 or $500,000, something, yeah. So we've done this exercise, although that was in a different time. And, you know, so circumstances, I think, you know, would make it look differently now, but I agree that the gross numbers make this look like it ought to be easy. It's when you get into the each in individual specifics, and you, especially when you take out some of the biggest ones and you say, well, those we just aren't going to do because we can't or we don't want to, we shouldn't, it does become a lot harder. And again, not that we shouldn't look at it on continual review. I got some hands up and I'm going to quit talking. Representative Barnhart and then Senator Corcoran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, one of the observations that I think is obvious, but I haven't actually heard yet, is that our method of organization actually impedes our capacity to adequately compare the tax expenditures to the actual direct budget. And the circumstances that have changed, of course, is that the direct budget is under a great deal more pressure than it was in 1999, when tax revenues were increasing, even with the tax expenditure increases that had occurred during the 2 years before and several years before that. I don't know if there's no easy method at this stage to do this, but it would certainly be wonderful if, as a part of this working process, we could get the consideration of the direct expenditure budget into the discussion of the tax expenditures, so that a reasonable comparison of value can be made. Because, of course, that comparison of value might be very different today than it would have been in 1999 if it was done then.
Well, and there is a connection at the highest levels. Senator Deckard and I meet with the co-chairs, and Paul Warner talks with Ken Rocco. I mean, short of making revenue a subcommittee of Ways and Means, you know, I don't know how you necessarily do that other than cross-communication, and I'm not one that would want to subsume the Revenue Committee into the Ways and Means process entirely, so the, you know, this is largely a matter of communication at the upper levels, and then I think probably some interim work groups like to look at it on a more systematic basis. Senator Corcoran and then Representative Harris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this is as much a question to Paul as it is to Tim and Lori. Has there been any research done on how you could apply means testing to personal income tax exemption, which is one of the largest tax expenditures, and to second home, the mortgage interest exemption? You know, what the difficulty that you run into with those is, and I've talked to Paul about this, is that if you attempt to look at the mortgage interest exemption, for example, it's extremely difficult to track a second home, a yacht, you know, how you finance it. You're financing it through your first home. The mortgage interest is the mortgage interest. And the same with it seems to me the personal income tax exemption would be a very interesting question to do some means testing at $100,000 adjusted gross income per household and bringing the personal exemption down in those cases. Has there been any examination of those numbers, any breakdowns of what those might yield?
Senator, we have looked at that to some extent, looking at phasing it out over income levels. We do have precedent at the federal level. Your exemptions are phased out at high income levels. The federal government also reduces the value of itemized deductions when you get to a certain income level. So there is that precedent, and it is something that's relatively straightforward for us to do in terms of the estimating the effects of the personal exemption credit. The other issue in terms of second homes and trying to determine some of the responses or some of the administrative implications for issues, that becomes an important element, I think, when you look at tax expenditures. There's the issue of policy, but there's also an issue of administration and compliance. And the example I always use here in this, the tax expenditure report, is a list of, I think it's $45 million on lottery earnings that are not taxed. Well, that's really the churn that goes through the machines, which from an administrative standpoint is really not obtainable. So there are some things in here that you'd have to ask the issue of, is it possible for the Department of Revenue to carry this out within a reasonable budget? But in terms of means testing, things like personal exemption credit, those are pretty straightforward, and we can give you estimates on those.
Representative.
Thank you. I also support a work group for this session to try and do something else. We have talked about on this committee also the idea. In fact, we have a bill that would create a commission that we've compared to the Federal Base Closure Commission to come back in the next session and use criteria like you set up here for an independent outside look to say, here's what's you know, highest priority, lowest priority, should be repealed, modified, or whatever. And I just wondered what you thought about taking that valuation outside of the legislature and setting up something like that where there's some trade-offs there. One, it would be easier for outside non-political people to do a thorough analysis, and two, they wouldn't have the political baggage that goes with having to deal with special interests.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hass, I think that it has merit to have some folks who would be perceived to be unbiased as a part of a work group. I also think that it would be valuable to have some folks with some expertise who've been working on this and crunching the numbers as a part of that. And I think time really is of the essence. I would certainly hate to see this be put off as an interim project when the needs go so wanting right now.
Other questions, comments, reflections? Did you want to respond to anything else that you've heard from up here?
No, I think we got
no, thank you for the time.
I want to thank you for the report. Excellent work on this. Now, this is draft number 13. Is it the final one? Is that it? You're going to quit at 13?
And tell the work group.
Lucky 13. We'll just put that down here. I appreciate your effort on this, and I want to thank everyone for coming in. Thank our Senate members for stopping by. You're always welcome to visit. And with that, we will close this informational meeting. Oh, sorry, what?
We had our second group coming up.
Oh, I didn't know we had another group.
I had told
you. Oh, okay, I'm sorry. Stay put. I'm sorry, I did not know that we had another group. That is Carmen. A couple days ago, we had Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet in here, and today we have Bizet's Carmen.
You know, I missed the second act of that play down in Shakespeare. How'd that thing turn out?
Badly.
Happy.
Badly.
Happy. Yes. Or people started happy.
All right, welcome.
Okay, thank you. Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, thank you for giving us the opportunity to testify before you today on this important issue. Mm-hmm. For the record, my name is Abby Solomon. I work for SEIU Local 503, OPEU. Our union represents more than 40,000 women and men who work to deliver quality public services in cities and towns across the state. We are the people who provide in-home care for the elderly and disabled, protect abused and neglected children, maintain our roads, forests, and parks, and work in countless state services that Oregonians depend on every day. Our organization has joined the Oregon Revenue Coalition because we believe that Oregon will not continue to be a livable state with vibrant communities if we are not able to provide adequate, stable funding for the public services that we pride ourselves on. Over the last biennium, the legislature repeatedly cut vital human service, public safety, and education programs. Programs like the Oregon Youth Authority, Assistance for the Medically Needy, and numerous others that keep our communities healthy and safe. At the same time, tax expenditures continue to grow, including the passage of new tax credits during recent special sessions. Every day, the Ways and Means Committee struggles line item by line item to balance program cuts with an ever-shrinking budget. Yet there is no equivalent process that biennially evaluates the usefulness of tax expenditures in meeting their intended goals. As a state, we need to ask ourselves if allowing tax credits like those that were outlined in the presentation that we heard today for things like the purchase and operation of foreign subsidiaries or luxury boats are more valuable than helping Oregon students attend our universities and become an educated part of our workforce, or having proper staffing in our long-term care facilities to support our rapidly aging population. SEIU Local 503 OPEU supports the effort of the Oregon Revenue Coalition to evaluate, reduce, and repeal unnecessary tax expenditures. In light of recent revenue forecasts and the prospect of cutting additional millions of dollars in program cuts, we urge you to support this proposal. As we reach out and ask unemployed Oregonians, school children, and public service workers to tighten their belts and pay their fair share, it's time we put a belt around our tax expenditures as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Ellen Wall.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, it's good to see senators here as well as representatives. I'm Ellen Lowe, and I'm here today representing the Human Service Coalition of Oregon. We're the umbrella group of providers, of advocates, of consumers. And our programs are really for the poor and the vulnerable. First of all, I'd like to show you what I did the first day of the session, because even though hearing rooms A and F seem a long ways away, I put into one notebook the tax expenditure report and the governor's budget, because over the years I really have come to see a significant connection between what happens at the two ends of the building. I'm not a usual member of the audience in this committee, because I spend my time down at the other end looking at budgets. But I remember one day hearing from one of those who frequents this committee that no one ever appears here to give up any of the tax benefits that they have. Well, perhaps I was anticipating Representative Barnhart's earlier question, because one of the things that I have provided to you is, out of the tax expenditure report, the materials on the additional medical deduction for elderly. It's for those of us who are over 62. And my family, we find ourselves well into that category. And what this particular benefit does, it allows us to deduct the full amount of our medical and dental expenses from our Oregon taxable income. And there is no means testing for this particular benefit. And so if you look in the chart that you will find in the tax expenditure report, you will see that for individuals, 26.8% of this benefit goes to individuals earning over $63,000. And at the bottom, I have put a chart that was provided to me, which estimates, again, what the incidence of this benefit will be in future, the two future biennia. Well, yesterday afternoon, I was at the other end of the building, and that's why I shared with you two pages out of the budget report from the Division for the Cluster for Seniors and People with Disabilities, which shows the financial eligibility for people who participate in the programs. And then I've also given you the sheet which was provided to us yesterday, which shows the thousands of people who have lost benefits, who share perhaps my age, and then also the number of those still in service. So I would say that if there is ever an example of where the two ends of the building ought to meet in terms of looking at the scale of justice, both social and economic, it ought to be related to health care. What I have also provided for you is the percentages, a graph that we used in a stakeholder group out of the Audit and Health Services Committee, where it shows the percentages of the federal poverty level when you are able to access various programs. And then at the bottom, a chart of the federal poverty level actually going up to 300%, and also, which is a way of looking at the income levels that really are governing many of the programs that come out of Hearing Room F, that come out of the budget of the Department of Human Services, that come out of the budget for housing and community services, that come out of some of the budgets, again, in the area of education. And so for my husband and me, we're offering to have this particular benefit means tested. And I would suggest that very many Oregonians, if they look at what's happening to seniors who are below that income, the federal poverty level, would want to join us in doing the same. I'd also like to echo in a personal way one of the personal examples that Mr. Nesbitt gave, and that was about the second home. And if indeed it is something that's difficult to administer, I think, again, mortgage deductions would be something that could very well be means tested. It might have a little impact on us as we put together the final plans for the house on the lot at Chapman Point. But still, it's far better to do something like that than, as I look at what happened in 5548, where the corpus for the Housing Trust Fund is offered up as the next revenue forecast proceeds. I think many other Oregonians would join me and would join the Human Service Coalition in looking through the tax expenditure report and finding a way of introducing more social and economic justice. Thank you so much for giving us this time this morning.
It's funny, you don't seem like a stranger down here. I guess your presence is felt enough when you're here that it seems like you're here very often.
Mr. Chair, actually, you may remember that Chuck Chekatoff and I were the ones who brought forward the idea of a tax expenditure report initially. So yeah. I have an investment in it.
You're very different. Patty.
Hi, I'm Patty Whitney Wise, the director for the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force, and we joined the Revenue Coalition because we can see the direct impact between continued cuts in human services programs and the incidence of hunger. It's clear to us that if this legislature does not raise some additional revenue, that a lot more Oregonians than we already have will be going hungry in the next biennium. For instance, the child care copays that were raised last fall as one of the cuts made in last year's budget means that many low-income families right at the edge of the poverty level now have to pay a significantly higher child care copay in order to go to work. That money comes directly out of the food budget. The food budget is one of the only budgets that has any flexibility in a family's income. The grocer is not knocking at the door saying, "Why aren't you coming in and spending your money at my grocery store?" But the landlord is there, your utility companies are there, and the child care provider must be paid. We cannot expect our low-wage workers to tighten their belts any further through this recession. We can look at many of the current tax expenditures to see if some of them could be eliminated without affecting a person's ability to put food on the table. In fact, from where we sit, this would be the first time during this recession that we've really asked those people in the middle and upper incomes to contribute towards the solution. They have a little wiggle room. People at the low end don't, and yet that's where most of our cuts have been focused. We don't want to continue being number one in hunger in this country. We want to see it go the other way. But our current budget for this next biennium will exacerbate the problem. We ask that you really seriously look at the Revenue Coalition proposals and what we can do to help make it a more equitable situation for people at the low end. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Shetterly and members of the committee, my name is Heidi McGowan and I'm the Oregon Director of Stand for Children. Stand for Children is a children's advocacy organization working to ensure that Oregon children grow up healthy, educated, and safe, and we are also a member of the Revenue Coalition. We have 1,000 members in Oregon across 7 chapters who have prioritized 2 top issues, early childhood education and stable and adequate funding of our schools. Members of Stand for Children right now are sharing story after story of children in class sizes up to 40 children in a class, 17 days being cut from their school. And as a parent, I'm seeing this firsthand. Matter of fact, my daughters aren't in school today because the Corvallis School District can't afford to keep their doors open. They're with Grandma, actually, probably having a great time. Stand for Children is asking for you and really urging you to take leadership on this critical issue that's been proposed by the Revenue Coalition. And to really ask the question, what's more important here, tax breaks that fail to provide jobs, new jobs, or the loss of up to 30 days in our schools, tax breaks on luxury boats or vacation homes, or the assurance of small class sizes, We ask you for your leadership and to scrutinize the tax breaks that are happening with the same effort that's being put into the scrutiny over our children's budgets. Thank you so much for this opportunity to share with you.
Thank you. Are there questions or comments for these witnesses? Okay. Thank you very much. Now, I closed the hearing too soon once this presentation was before. And do we have somebody else that you've lined up to, as far as your panel? I don't want to just open it up to public testimony, but okay, that's it. All right, I want to thank, again, the Revenue Coalition for their work on this. I guess I would comment, too. I think this is something that has evolved in large part, because of the work that Ellen and Chuck Sheketoff and others did in bringing about this tax expenditure report. It really gave us a way to highlight these and look at these as adjuncts of the Ways and Means and budgeting process to compare these against appropriations. And so I think over time, as this becomes part of the culture of the legislature, I think it's been very useful to see tax expenditures in that light, and it will certainly help us on an ongoing basis evaluate it.
This is totally a protocol that
you're right. If you want to just leave it with Tara, that's fine. Okay, thanks. You bet. All right. Thank you, everybody, for coming in. Committee, we have one more work session. We'll see if we are ready to go to. We just let while the room clears before we get to this tax credit.
How about the legislative project?
Before we do what?
Before we get to this tax credit.
How will Bill become law?
Isn't
it's Deborah's.
Oh,
it's
Deborah's. Yeah.
Right. This is the Williams equivalent.
Yeah, that's the Williams equivalent. How an idea in Max's head becomes a law.
Deborah
loses.
Tony.
Oh, months ago.
Now he has to progress.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's look just
that.
A longer.
He has become.
A longer
this
meaning.
This
yeah.
This is how.
We're
voting on Deborah McCrory. Well, I said that it had to do. I mean, McCrory is the argument and everything.
How ironic!
Yeah, well, that's why he got
the ironic bird.
That's the Freudian.
How are you both?
Well, this is very interesting.
Well, and then of course, the notion could be...
There's some negative.
Pretty good, how about you?
Tens of rock to find out.
Oh.
And if they want to turn
to no, the
You might not always be happy. Some of them.
Like, I think what you need to do is get across one goal line. And I think we'll start looking for the next one by moving tons of rock.
Okay. Let's get back to work. Kim, is Representative Sephora anywhere to be seen? She's coming down? Okay. All right. If we could restore some semblance of order here.
At first.
Okay, let's get Lisbeth up here before we go into our work session on House Bill. Okay, 3184. Lisbeth, come on.
Is 18 coming out there?
No. We're still waiting on a fiscal on that. Okay, let me open a work session on House Bill 31. Did I open that already? Anyway, here it is, 3184.
Okay. Chairman Shetterly, with House Bill 3184, you have a -3 amendment. So basically, with the -3 amendment, we we were discussing last time with the Dash 2 amendment, and all this really does is clarify that issue that was brought forward with the Dash 2 amendment dealing with how we would treat this particular contribution, and if the federal government decided to allow that as a charitable contribution to the child care fund, then in Oregon here, lines 23 through 27 on page 4 of the Dash 3 amendment is all that's added to the Dash 2 amendment, and basically this states that if an amount is claimed as a credit under this section and it is allowed as a deduction for federal tax purposes, so if the federal government does decide that's a charitable contribution, then the amount allowed as a credit under this section shall be added back then to the federal taxable income in Oregon. So that's the important thing, is this does clarify that they would not get a deduction here in Oregon for the credit amount. So if they took a credit, they would add that back to their Oregon taxable income. And that's all that the Dash 3 does. It was in addition to the Dash 2. It clarifies that point. So, again, with the bill, it's adding some technical corrections to the child care division credit, really just dealing with the they needed additional language dealing with the tax credit marketer, and so it adds a definition for high quality child care and tax credit marketer. It changes some of those responsibilities of the child care division pertaining to the distribution of that child care credit, and then it basically authorized child care to adopt rules and select a tax credit marketer who agrees to market the tax credits. Then it allows the child care division's rules to establish a fixed percentage that is less than 100% that could be applied to all tax credits. And it specifies that child care division shall issue tax credits in the order in which they are received. And it clarifies that the total value of all certificates issued by the division each year is limited to $500,000. It raises the threshold from $80,000 to $85,000 of the median income of the region of child care clients of the home-based businesses in order for the community agency to receive any child care division funds. And then, again, it's clarifying then that deduction for federal purposes shall be, the credit amount shall be added back for Oregon's taxable income. And then the main thing that gives you a revenue impact for the bill, again, is just the extension of the sunset. It's extended out 2 years to January 1st, 2009. So the revenue impact is just $500,000 per year. Up to that maximum amount beginning tax year 2007.
Okay. Deborah, do you want to just come up and give us the high sign on these that we've...
Mr. Chair, is there something ominous about the back bench on this thing today?
Yeah. Yeah, we were talking about tax credits.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue, I think this works just fine. This would require either individuals or corporations to add back any amount they're claiming as a credit if it's in federal taxable.
So we fixed the, I think double dipping was the issue we were most concerned with
for the
before.
Oregon, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, you mentioned individuals, corporations. Who's likely most to claim this credit, you know?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure who it's being marketed to.
Anybody back there answer this? I'm just wondering which category it goes under.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rebecca Schein. I serve on the State Advisory Committee to the Child Care Division on this program. We expect it to be a combination. We've been looking at other tax credits that are support working families, that support affordable housing, and there's a combination, and we wanted to leave it available to both.
As I recall from our discussion 2 years ago, it seemed to me we were thinking mostly businesses would
It's very likely, but being that the goal is private sector investment, if that comes from individuals or corporations, we're equally happy.
Okay. I was just an idle question. Sure. Sorry, don't mean to go anywhere by it. Okay, thank you very much. Any questions for these folks or any of the other backbenchers who probably know more than they want to let on? Okay, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Gafori, you're okay too. Thumbs up on the dash threes. Okay, we are in work session.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Williams.
I would move the dash three amendments to the bill.
Representative Williams moves the dash three amendments to House Bill 3184. Is there any discussion on the dash threes? Any objection? Hearing none.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Williams.
I would move House Bill 3184 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
House Bill 3184 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? All right, please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. House Bill 3184 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Carrier, you don't want to carry this?
Carrier?
You're shaking here. Do you want to carry it? Okay, Representative Gafori.
Sure.
Okay. All right, close the work session on 3184, and then we have, before we all run away, Paul, do you want to talk about it? Do you want Steve to come down and talk about it? You can do it, can't you? I'd like to bring him down just to...
I don't know.
What are
we
going to
talk about?
Okay.
Mr. Chair, we did anticipate, or Steve anticipated, that the questions we would get is with the co-chair's budget on how that looks run through the school distribution formula. So he went ahead and prepared that for you yesterday. The only thing I might note is that it does compare with the 2002-03 estimated numbers after the special sessions. So you have a low number there in terms of what we're comparing with, rather than, for example, the adopted budget. You do see there is a big jump in the first year. In the second year, the assumption is the same as we saw with the governor's budget, that it would essentially be flat funded with PERS savings kicking in at that time, which is kind of the assumption that's made in the governor's budget as well. So there may be some movement between those 2 years in the budget process, but that was our interpretation of where we are right now. And it gives you just a first look at what the implications are of the co-chair's budget.
Okay.
I know there was some discussion or confusion about the accounting change. Is that factored in here? Are we looking at that increase because of that accounting shift, or?
We have left the accounting piece out, the accrual piece out, because you know that it shouldn't affect the year-to-year changes. If you are going to, of course, it's up to the districts whether they do that or not, and the districts that do it should therefore pull it forward in future years as well. So it may affect the levels on any given year, but it shouldn't affect the change from year to year much.
So it doesn't.
It's not in.
It doesn't affect the comparison that we see here from 2003 to 2004.
Correct.
Okay.
Well, then I have a question, because I think you just said it does affect the comparison. I think what he just said, let me say it a different way and you see if you agree with this. I think what you said was the amount of the shift is not reflected in the number you have for 2003. It's not there. And therefore, if a school district went out and borrowed money, that would be they would end up actually spending more than what shows up in the dollars per ADMW in 2003.
Richard Barnhart, that's correct. They would if they went ahead and pulled forward in 2003, but we assume that if they did that in 2003, they would also do it in 2003-04 and 2004-05, so on down the line. So in other words, it won't affect the change from year to year.
It does not affect the amount of money we give them. It may change the amount of money they actually spent last time.
That's correct. But it will not change the percentage change from year to year for the districts.
Yeah. See, what I'm trying to do is I ask this question. I'm trying to shift perspectives. This is the perspective from the state budgeting point of view.
Yes.
The perspective from school spending point of view might in fact be quite different from this, because they may have gone ahead and borrowed money and spent it last time, and then of course be in the position of having to do it again this time, and so that the amount they actually spent would be quite a bit more than what shows up on the 2003 side. As long as I understand what happened, I'm okay with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a criticism, just simply a comment.
Yes, and Representative Barner, I think your characterization is that, yes, it is from a state budgeting standpoint.
Right.
That's the perspective we've
right.
used.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions of Paul on this? Make note that simulation 7, we're likely to see a lot higher numbers than that before we get done. Okay. All right. Thank you, everybody. We are adjourned and have a good weekend.